Today's episode is brought to you by the eCommerce Fuel Private Community, the most vibrant and active discussion forum for owners of seven and eight-figure e-commerce businesses. So how is it any different from other communities online or DTC Twitter? Three big reasons. First, it's vetted. Everyone inside owns a seven or eight-figure business. Average member does about $5 million top line per year. About 15% are doing it with eight figures. You get advice from owners who have actually been there in the trenches and that you know you can trust it because we vetted them and they're actually doing what they say they are. Secondly, no pitching. There's no affiliate links, no vendors hawking stuff at you. This is just real operators sharing what's working. And then finally, reciprocity is one of our biggest values when we moderate. We require that everyone shares something when they come in so you learn from them, but also we don't let people just come in and strip mine the community for information so you get a really healthy dynamic group. So confident this will be a game changer for your business that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. Join the community, stay for a year, and if you don't see 10x the value relative to your membership fees, we'll refund all of them plus give you $1,000 just for the hassle. So if it sounds interesting, check us out. We'd love to have you apply, and you can learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Looking for help to get the most out of your Shopify store? Don't waste time on theory or untested advice. Instead, download Zipify apps and copy one of the world's most successful Shopify stores. Zipify was created by my friend Ezra Firestone, and you probably know Ezra because he's been a guest on this podcast many times, but he's also the owner of multiple eight and nine-figure e-commerce brands, including a $175 million store he built from scratch. And he's created two Shopify apps so you can leverage the same strategies he's using to scale his stores. One-Click Upsell is already the number one upsell app for over 18,000 Shopify stores, including brands like Tushy, Dr. Squash, Buffy, Jones Soda, and Victoria Beckham. And it's so effective that the average One-Click Upsell user boosts their total revenue by 10 to 15% practically overnight. And then there's Zipify Pages. Pages is the most user-friendly landing page builder on Shopify, and it's stacked with over 70 marketing templates so you can quickly generate leads, launch promotions, and drive more sales. And since both apps are tested first on Ezra's own eight and nine-figure stores, you know they actually work. You can try out One-Click Upsell and Zipify Pages for free at Zipify.com. That's Zipify.com to try both out for free. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the eCommerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, longtime friend, longtime member of ECF, someone I've admired for years, the way he's built his business and run it, and just generally fun, great human being, and that's Brian Goulet. He is the owner and co-founder of the Goulet Pen Co. You can find that at GouletPens.com. They sell fountain pens, the old-fashioned, you know, ink-filled, beautiful. When you get a note from someone and it just looks like, you know, someone's put a lot of time and love and care into that, chances are it's written with something like that. So yeah, excited to geek out with him on a bunch of things, particularly his very unique approach to growth. A lot of people love to grow at like all costs. He has a much more, I think, interesting, rational approach to growth. He's an OG in the YouTube space. We're going to talk about YouTube. He's been doing it for 15 years. For longer than some of the people doing YouTube, before they were born, knows a ton about the space and just generally talk about life and some of the challenges since COVID. So Brian, good to have you on, and we didn't get to chat as much as I wanted to at live. So I'm looking forward to this, man.
Oh, I'm very happy to be on. I love listening to the podcast and getting to hear what I feel like are my friends being interviewed all the time. Hopefully I can add some value to the listeners out there.
I have a hunch you'll be able to based on past discussions and interviews and stuff. Question for you though, coming back from live, what was your favorite talk that you saw at live?
Oh gosh. There were a lot of really good ones. Of course, it's always great to hear from Bill because I touch base with him at every event and all the roller coaster ride of various things that he's been through. It's inspiring and humbling at the same time. And then let's see here. Probably this, I liked hearing about the AI stuff, honestly. Not that I'm like a total AI fanboy everything, but it's like, it's definitely something I'm paying attention to.
Did you have a tool that popped out? One tool that we've started using at ECF, and I got to give the credit to Patrick for discovering or at least, putting this on our radar. We've used ChatGPT for, last year plus, like almost everyone. There's a tool called Claude. It's by Anthropic.
Yeah, Claude. I think I'm,
Claude, yeah. And that has been, it seems like the voice, the ability to replicate a voice, but even more importantly, the larger context windows for being able to dump more content in there is a game changer. And so it's been fun experimenting with that. So what is anything you're using that has been notable recently?
Yeah, I mean, I'm paying attention to a lot of the video stuff. So a lot of that is not necessarily out and ready to use for the public. I mean, I think OpenAI announced Sora like a couple of weeks before Live happened.
Yeah.
So we've been able to see some demos and stuff. Haven't been able to play with it yet, but you know, like you mentioned at the start of this, I've been playing around with video stuff for like 14, 15 years. So certainly the tools that are out there for video, I mean, I've had to edit my own stuff. I've got editors. I've got, you know, I've had to do kind of the full gamut, do a lot of my own shooting, recording, whatever. So having better tools and stuff like that is very appealing.
I want to dive in to your thoughts on growth and kind of financing a business and things like that, because I feel like there's so many people in our space who are just like, go out, if you're growing, borrow a bunch of money to be able to propel your growth forward. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense. Sometimes it doesn't. If you are growing really quickly and your limiting factor is cash to buy inventory, you know, I'm probably a little bit on the medium side when it comes to risk aversion to debt. But I feel like if you have a really, you know, items are just exploding and you can't fund the purchase, it makes a lot of sense to be able to borrow something at 7% annually that you can buy, turn around and sell for 3x as much, right? Like good math. You have a little bit of risk if you can't sell. You got to be careful on purchases. But there's also times people just take that to the extreme and like there's a self-imposed stress of, hey, I don't think people sometimes realize the trade-off that they are intentionally making between stress and growing a company really quickly and that they can slow down. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, so I'm putting words in your mouth here, but you seem like you have a much different approach to growth and financing your company. And I mean, you've built this 8-figure pen company over the years. I'd love to hear how you think about that. Like, how do you think about growth and financing and debt as it pertains to building a bigger business? And how has that looked for you over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I've taken a very conservative approach towards growth. We've still had pretty decent, like you said, you know, it's been 15 years and we're 8-figure. So it's like, I never dreamed that we'd ever be here. So I'm like, well, I'm pretty happy with how it's turned out. I can't really be discontented with anything. Like, how much faster would I have wanted it to grow?
You could have been a billionaire, man. You left $1 billion on the table.
Sure, I guess. But like, I don't know. I could also be broke and lying and face down in a ditch. Like, you know, there's trade-offs to everything. Like, not everything always works out.
Totally.
You know, some of it too is like just your own, you know, risk aversion. That's, I think, a really important thing to keep in mind, especially when you're kind of first starting out. You know, we all want to be optimistic and all that. And I think, you know, for the last decade or so, money's been cheap. So to take on debt has been not as risky. 15 years ago, it was more like an environment like what you have right now, where it was not just like free money floating around everywhere. I mean, we started this business in kind of the bottom of the housing crisis. So there was not the same, like, just give anybody money who wants it kind of a thing. Like, we'd all been burned pretty bad as a country from that happened from, like, you know, the housing bubble. And so, frankly, it was kind of not really an option for me to take out a lot of debt because I graduated college, was trying to get my little business off the ground, didn't really have a lot of credit to my name, so to speak. So, you know, money was not just being thrown around everywhere. So I sort of had my best option was to just kind of bootstrap it. And I don't have a super high margin product. I mean, I'm basically a third-party retailer. I'm buying wholesale and I'm selling retail, usually through a U.S. distributor, because a lot of my products, fountain pens, come from Italy, Japan, Germany, France, you know, places that are more fountain pen-centric in their culture. That's where a lot of the manufacturers are, is in those countries. So there's usually, you know, a bit of a language barrier and stuff like that to buy direct. So it makes a lot more sense to go through a distributor. You know, so for us, for me and my wife, Rachel, when we started out doing this, it was literally just like we bought a few pads of paper and some bottles of ink and we listed them online and started selling them. And I would post a video review about it. And, you know, then people would, like, if they liked it, then they would buy more ink. And I would say, okay, what ink do you like next? You know, and then they would tell me and I'd go source that. So it was very much like a feedback loop directly with customers of, here's this thing you asked for. Okay, now what do you want next? And I would just take whatever I made from that previous thing and roll it into the next product. So it was very, you know, it was very slow going at first in a lot of ways.
How much capital did you have when you started out?
Oh, I don't even know if you could really call it capital. maybe 2 grand. Okay. Maybe. I mean, we had just gotten a mortgage, and we had my wife was 7 months pregnant with our first kid. When
sounds like a good time to start a business
website in the middle of a financial crisis. Why not? You know, selling a product you've never really dealt with before.
Let's YOLO this.
100%. But it was some of it was just like the circumstances. You know, we were 25 at the time and starting a family young. And it was like, all right, I'm really motivated to try to make this work. You know, it was like, it wasn't like we were going to be out on the streets if it didn't work. We had some backup plans. You know, we both graduated from college. So we were very fortunate in that we had, you know, options that we could pursue if this whole thing didn't work out. So by the time we got into the retail thing, it was miraculous to me to have anything left over, you know, after we sold something. So it was like a revelatory at that time. And I was like, oh, this is a model that could actually work for us. You know, we just had to literally learn everything from scratch and had no money to do it. So what could go wrong?
So where did it, you know, you built the business, start with very little capital, start scaling up. Where did you talk about the first time where you made the intentional decision to grow more slowly with less risk? Because I feel like that's like, maybe either an exact moment, if you can remember it, or just a rough period where you know, you could have accelerated growth with taking a PayPal loan or getting a bank loan or something, but you decided, hey, I don't want to do this. I'd rather, because it sounds like everything has grown organically. You've just plowed the profits back into the business, right?
100%. Yeah. That's how it's been from the very beginning. Yeah. We did borrow the one little bit of money that we did borrow. I borrowed some money from my parents, like maybe 10 grand. After we were in the business for about 6-8 months in its current form, selling fountain pen stuff. Literally, it's just like we had a couple of brands that we knew that our customers wanted. We literally just needed to place the like opening purchase order to get it. And then once it sold through, we paid my parents back after like a couple of months. So that was the only debt that we ever took on was that initial, you know, kind of loan from my parents. They were grateful enough to do that. You know, theoretically, yes, I could have gone out to a bank and done that. Would I have done that if I hadn't had that option for my parents? You know, I don't know. But I think also because it was my parents, that was the only reason I felt comfortable taking that money, you know, because I knew that they would be understanding if we couldn't make it work or it took longer to pay back or whatever. But I really never pursued going to a bank because it was like, well, any initial debt that I would take out would be mostly for inventory. And if the inventory wasn't going to sell, well, then if I'm a retail business, like, why am I doing any of this? Like, I need to be able to sell what it is that I'm offering. So I always kind of viewed it as, well, I'm only going to pick up the stuff that customers really want and that they're asking for. And if it sells quickly, you know, if I can get 30-day or 45-day terms on those products, and if it sells and I don't overbuy, well, then I should be able to pay that back pretty quickly. And, you know, that is largely how it worked. So we were able to sort of, I don't know, I guess get super short-term loans from some of our suppliers. And, you know, it wasn't everybody and it wasn't, you know, perfect, but it was enough to help us to kind of, you know, get it off the ground. But again, it was always tempered, right? Like, so it wasn't like I could just pick up every brand. And in fact, we didn't sell fountain pens for the first year. It was just ink and paper to go along with fountain pens. So like our average product cost might've been like $10, $15, you know? So it wasn't high dollar, it wasn't high margin items. It really was just, we had to turn products. And the only way we could do that is if we knew that that's what our customers wanted. So it was a lot of customer engagement and, you know.
Did you have any periods when you would sell out of an item? Let's say, for example, you had, you know, fountain pen X that you just wildly in demand, you knew people would buy it and your growth was limited based on the quantity you had on hand, and you would have loved to buy more, but you didn't have cash on hand to do that. Did you have to make a lot of decisions? Did you make the intentional decision, hey, I know we could accelerate growth, but we'd have to take on some leverage and some complexity. We're not going to do that. We're okay at growing at a slower pace. Or has the trajectory of growth just been kind of at such a consistent gradual pace that you were always able to fund your growth options through those terms, supplier terms, and also through just cash flow and retained earnings?
Yeah, I would say for us, for me and Rachel, because we're equal partners in this and we still work together today. So, you know, if I say we, it's basically her and I am talking about. For us, it was more of like from the beginning, it was kind of just an approach that we were taking towards the business that was, we did not want to go leveraged. So it's not like I pursued it and couldn't really get it. it was more just like, I didn't want to even take that on. Because keeping in mind, in the beginning for us, it was just, can we both draw a paycheck? Like if her and I could work from home and raise our kids in our little house, and that's all it ever was, we made it. Like that was it. Just having super low expectations for what the business even would be. I mean, it's pretty hard not to be content if you can achieve that. You know, for us at least, that's kind of what it was. I don't want to grow much faster than we are, because then it felt like the relationship that we had with ourselves, with our customers, with our suppliers, with our employees, like that felt like that would get strained if we grew too fast. So in a way, I found it as a helpful limiter to not take on debt. Not to say that that's right for everybody, you know, because again, the nice thing that we had in our situation, which this is not everybody's case, but we had, you know, an established supply chain that was not super sophisticated. You know, fountain pens are maybe not like the peak bleeding edge of technology, right? So they're pretty established. Most of the stores that are selling these products are like stationery stores, art supply stores, you know, primarily, especially at that time, 2009 or so, they were brick and mortar centric. Really wasn't a lot online. So things moved a little slower in that industry than maybe in some others. So we had, I'll call it the luxury of taking things a little bit slower in the fact that the products that we were selling, you know, allowed for that. And then also because we had established US distributors, they were importing the stuff. So they would deal with the container shipping prices and fluctuations of currency and all this type of stuff. We would more or less just buy, we would establish the relationship with our distributor, and then we would just have to buy from them in case packs and stuff like that. So the amount of investment that we had to have and the lead time that we had on getting those products was far shorter than it would be if we were, you know, sourcing direct from overseas and buying container loads at a time.
So, yeah, that makes sense. When you think about, you know, 2024 going forward, you know, I kind of one thing I've realized, and I kind of thought about this a little out loud in the past, but like if you look at what was rare 15 years ago, it was, you know, the ability to get a website online. 10 years ago, it was, you know, it was the ability to advertise well. You know, five to 10 years ago is the ability to have sourcing partners and be able to get things from overseas. And now the things that are rare are very different, right? Like there's a lot of people that have those skills with implications for the future business. So I spend a lot of time thinking now, like what is rare today that you can help build a business around? And I think some of those things are community. I think conviction is one. I think really differentiated products. So anyway, all that said, like you're in this space and you're a little different. You've got a real, you know, a legacy business with like a great reputation. You've got these supplier relationships that may or may not be exclusive. Do you feel like you're able, looking forward the next 5 to 10 years, you'll be able to keep that same business of reselling pens given kind of that moat that you've created around brand and relationships? Or are you thinking like, okay, we're going to need to pivot a little bit and to start making our own things? How are you thinking about the business model going forward?
That's a really, really good question. Pretty much everybody who sells products right now is having to ask those same questions and kind of up and down the whole supply chain. Like just not just me as a retailer, you know, we serve as kind of an intermediary, right? So it's like we're dealing directly with the end user, the consumer, the whatever you want to call it. Those all sound very impersonal, but like the people who love pens, we are dealing directly with them.
With the writers.
Yeah, the writers. Yeah. And like there's a community there for sure. And that's like really heavily what we've invested in for the last 15 years. That's why we have the reputation we do. But to make pens is an entirely different skill set, an entirely different set of problems. You know, so my approach has always been, I'm going to let the people that do that really well focus on that. And I'm going to focus on making them the best people at that and support them. Like I don't look at it as like there's a bunch of just like middle people that are just making money all along the way. Certainly that can happen. And maybe in some industries it's more. The fountain pen industry though, I mean, fountain pens are complicated. They're hard to make. A lot of the companies that make them are like multi-generational family businesses. And it's just very, very much fueled by passion. And there's a lot of parts to a pen. So the raw materials, the supplies, all that, a lot has to come together for pens to even exist at all. So I really respect what the manufacturers do to make pens happen at all. Really, it's like us as a retailer doing a lot of education and support is super important. The distributor supporting the retailer is really important. The manufacturers making products well, it's really important. So I don't view it as like, there's a lot of fat in the process. you know, the way I see it, at least in the fountain pen world, like, you know, I don't look at how much it costs to make something and be like, oh, well, this is so much cheaper. We should just do that. I'm like, no, I know it's a ton of work and it's a lot of time and a lot of knowledge to be able to do that well. So I view it as like, there's a role to play that we have as a retailer. Let me focus on what we can do the absolute best, which is like learn our products inside and out, learn how they interact together, learn our customers really well, put out great content that is very like hands-on, you know, relatable to someone that would actually be using a pen day to day, building that community, you know, being that friendly, approachable, you know, face to the brand. That's all the stuff that like literally from day one, I had very top of mind. If there's anything I can probably drive home the most about like what I think is attributed to our success and my success as the, you know, the CEO is no matter what business you're in the business of people. Like these are not just products or numbers or AI or whatever. Like it is people serving people. And the more that you can keep that in mind, the more successful you're going to be and the more human you're going to appear. And then, you know, also that's your hedge against other people who are probably going to be able to replicate a lot of what you're able to do. But no matter what, and this is something I've always kept in mind because Amazon was like the big threat to retail, even back in 2009, it was like they were kind of the gorilla in the room that was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And obviously now they're, you know, no one can compete really, especially in an independent e-commerce seller. But AI is like kind of a similar kind of a threat. It's like this existential thing, like, oh my gosh, it's going to take over everything. I'm like, well, that's okay. That's fine. But like, I am the only me that's out there. So if I can have my unique skills, abilities, if I can be relatable, I can share myself, my views, my content, my creation, my relatable, you know, the community, that's something that like you can mimic it. And now with AI, you can mimic it better than ever before, but you can't replace it.
Hey, it's Andrew here. The quick sidebar to introduce you to Tal from popsmith.com. He's one of the owners over there where they create the absolute coolest, most delicious popcorn popper I've ever seen. I love it. Our kids love it. And Tal is an OG. He's been in the community for 10 years, instrumental in being getting it going and off the ground and leading a number of meetups in California. And just a fantastic guy. And here's a snapshot of his experience with the community over the years with eCommerce 2, our community for 7 and 8-figure store owners.
So many benefits to being part of the community. So many really sincere, hardworking, really smart business owners. They're all in e-commerce, just like me. So it's just been such an awesome community to be a part of, and so much value add opportunity from people that are in the trenches, just like me, doing e-commerce, staying relevant, working hard. Incredibly deep friendships that I've made and deep connections that I've made throughout the years. And I mean, just so much business benefit. And it's a community that it's one of the few communities that I'm actively a part of, and a community that I genuinely want to not just benefit from, but to give back, because that's how much I care about the members that are all part of this. They're all just trying to be decent human beings, decent entrepreneurs, and be better at work and life. And so the value has just been, I mean, it's invaluable, the connections and the value and the advice that I've gotten from the community. Big believer, huge fan, will be with it, in it, as long as, well, forever. Appreciate you.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show.
Yeah, no, 100%. I do think that, I think there's some people that take the viewpoint that AI is going to create all these influencers and people are going to follow them. And you might have that in pockets and spheres, but yeah. I think people will crave actually real people and real influencers. I was going to ask you on the supplier front, all the things you mentioned, you know, connection, education, all of those definitely help kind of build a moat. Do you have with your relationships for importing pins, are many of those like exclusive relationships with importing to the United States or your geographical region? Because that seems like that would be one of the most powerful things you could have also. Like if you build a great, relationship with a supplier and you're the only place they're going to sell through in your country because you have that great relationship, that's a massive moat as well. And then you can kind of get the benefits of controlling the supply chain without having to run the factory, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the way that it works in the fountain pen world, at least, it can be a little bit different, but most of them, you have the manufacturer that makes the stuff. Typically, it's just single location factory. They're making the stuff. They're typically selling through distributors that operate in different regions. So you might have like North American, European, you know, might just kind of regionally that will handle, you know, a multitude of countries. And it's usually an exclusive relationship with that distributor. Because again, most of these fountain pen companies are not that big. Some of them might be 10 people, 20 people, you know, and they've got some equipment. There's some that are bigger, 300 or 400 people, but none of them are massive. So it's a very boutique kind of industry. So it is extremely relational from the manufacturer all the way through to the retail and the end user. So, you know, there is some exclusivity that goes on. It's more at the distribution level. So me as a retailer, I don't have exclusivity on most of my products. Now, over time, as I've gotten a good reputation, as our business has grown, we've been more successful, we've been able to work with our distributors to get to the level where we can actually reach some of the, you know, MOQs, like the minimum quantity purchased for individual designs and pens and stuff like that. So if we want to do an exclusive color or an exclusive offering on an existing design or work with the manufacturer to develop something together, we're at the point now where we're large enough where we can do that and we can cover those minimums. That opens up to a lot more opportunities. But the way that we're doing that is not through like a white label kind of thing. Because again, fountain pens are so niche. And basically, if I white labeled any pen, my customers immediately would know who made it because they know the designs. They know what makes pens different from brand to brand. So there's no hiding any of that. So, and nor is there a need to. Like, there's brand equity in the manufacturers that are long established. You know, some of them, there's a number of fountain pen brands that have been around for over 100 years. So it's like, why would I not want to, you know, utilize that brand equity and that trust that's there with those brands? So typically what we'll do is we'll partner together and we'll have an exclusively offered product through our store, and it'll still be branded under the manufacturer's name, but the color or the model or whatever it is, we will be the only ones that have it. So you have to get it through us. And that's, you know, that's about 15 to maybe 20% of our sales is exclusives. And we spend an extraordinary amount of time developing those and, you know, working with our suppliers to try to come up with those. But, you know, it's kind of a unique way probably that we end up doing that than maybe what most other ECF members are doing. But it's a very important part for exactly the reason you mentioned. Like, we sell the same stuff that you can get at any other retailer. So yeah, having those exclusives, yeah, is a way for us, you know, to have something that no one else does.
That's smart. Changing gears a little bit, YouTube, you've been doing YouTube since, man, like it said at the top, 2010, you know, 15
I'm an OG.
Years.
Yeah.
OG,
yeah.
Been doing it forever. Are you still seeing it as a pretty meaningful sales channel and attention channel for you? Are you seeing it still perform? YouTube's one of those things that, like, there are very few platforms that have been around and has been as effective over the years for a lot of people. YouTube, I mean, YouTube, I don't know if it was 2004, 2005, when it was either created or bought by Google, I can't remember. But they're pushing 20 years of being a viable platform. And I feel like you've seen so many other, like even Facebook, it's still huge. And Meta is a massive platform. But the viability of ads, like ads have just gotten more expensive there. Other platforms have gotten much harder. And I'm sure YouTube has gotten harder, but it still seems like a lot of people are having success with it. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts. How are you still investing heavily there? Do you still see a lot of potential on the platform? And how do things look? You know, what's the lay of the land in YouTube 2024?
Yeah, I've had to adapt. I mean, it's been very different throughout the years. I mean, it's, you know, in the beginning, it's like there was a 10-minute cap on how long you could make YouTube videos. And if I had you know, I'm not concise in my speaking, so I can't make short videos very easily. So I need to talk for a long time, and that's just fine. That's just who I am. So, you know, I had to break videos into parts and stuff like that on YouTube. So if you go, I still have them all up there. So if you go back and look at my oldest videos, you'll see like part one, part two, whatever. And it's like, oh, so kludgy the way it had to go together. But that was it. That was the limitation. But at the time, YouTube back in 2010, it wasn't like the place people were hanging out. You know, I had a blog and I would embed the YouTube video onto my blog and everybody would look at the blog in their RSS reader, you know, and that's how they would get their content. And so YouTube to me was just a video hosting platform. It was never a community that I was focused on building anything there. Over time that developed and there were comments on there and people would leave comments and I'm like, oh, there's like actually people here like paying attention. I kind of drive myself crazy a little bit sometimes trying to figure out what YouTube wants, but also like I don't run ads. So at the end of the day, I don't really care that much if I'm like plugged into the most viral thing. I'm like, look, if people want to use fountain pens, they need engaging content. It needs to be entertaining to a degree, but it mostly needs to be educational. And are they going to trust me? Am I going to give them good information, education? Am I going to give them a good introduction to the fountain pen world? And if so, that is, you know, whether the numbers are amazing or just okay, that's more important to me. And what I can say is like, if I look at, you know, the UTM tags that we put on our product links and our YouTube video descriptions, they would be nothing to write home about. Like it does not show by those numbers that we're getting a lot of sales directly from YouTube. But we have a post-purchase survey on our website that asks people where, you know, where they found out about us and what platform drove them to their purchase. And it's like up, you know, mid to upper 40% of people are saying that YouTube influenced their decision. So I'm like, okay, like I always knew that YouTube was really important for us, but it's the kind of thing, especially having done it for so long and put it out there, there's a huge trust factor and a huge relatability factor that people have, especially because I've put myself in the as the face in so many of these videos. People associate me and the trustworthiness and the relatability that I have to, you know, their confidence in buying from my company. And then, of course, you have to follow through with that with good products and service support and all that kind of stuff. But you do that for, you know, a decade plus, and that gets you a really, really solid reputation. So as far as I'm concerned, like,
what's the gap between the attribution you said 40% plus post-purchase would attribute?
Yeah, that's just like of the people that do the post-purchase survey that say that YouTube influenced their thing. I don't have like a dollar amount to associate
I'm tracking with you there. I was just wondering what's the delta?
The gap?
Like if you look at like your analytics huge platform would say like, I mean, it's gotta be massive. I'm guessing 5-10% maybe. So you're seeing probably a 3-4x lift where people are coming to you, where it's unattributable.
Oh, I mean, like the direct. I mean, take all social platforms, not just YouTube. I mean, we're active on Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, whatever. You know, Twitter. We're all over the place. Facebook. You know, we do all that stuff, but mostly it's organic and direct stuff. We're not doing a lot of ads. If you add all of the referral traffic we get from all social media, YouTube, everything, you know, it's minuscule. I mean, it's basically a rounding error of our overall sales. So if you looked at it purely by the numbers in that way, you would say, why are you doing any of this? You're spending so much time on these platforms. The numbers don't support any of that. But I'm like, yeah, but we're not doing ads to drive directly to a landing page to make a sale, last click attribution. That's never the approach that we've taken. You know, email is probably the most direct one that we can associate to, because that's like, you know, hey, we've launched this thing, go buy it now. We have it in stock. That's the more obvious one, and SMS to a degree. But for all of our social stuff, it's just, you know, here's how to use and clean and fill a pen, and here's some things that are kind of new or whatever. Go check it out when you get a chance. But people do a lot of research and stuff like that with fountain pen purchasing. So it's very difficult to make direct attribution to any like piece of content that we create. And, you know, the direct sale, it's all just branding. It's all brand building. So it's much squishier and harder to put hard numbers to. So, you know, part of that is like, if I was trying to get a venture capital and they would want me to tie some numbers to it, I'd be like, your guess is as good as mine, because it's mostly just instinctual.
But you don't have to guess though. I mean, you've got, that's, I think that's the point I was trying to make, is the post purchase survey is so valuable because there's so many untrackable things that you're not going to see unless you ask. Like for us, people joining our community, the biggest driver is word of mouth, like 40%. And there's no way you're going to know that unless you take a survey.
Unless you ask. That, there's survey bias and things like that that you got to kind of weed through. But yeah, it's very similar. I think the fountain pen community is also very tight and it's very word of mouth too. So I think there's some of that too. I mean, the number of customers that I've had that have said, I've watched your video for 3 years and I finally made a purchase. I'm like, what do you attribute that to? You know, it's like people will follow us on social, they'll get emails for a year, you know, before they make their first purchase. And then when they do, they make 20 purchases in a month. You know, it's like, how do you make attribution towards all that? The numbers get pretty whacked out pretty quick.
Brian, I want to wrap up with a lightning round here quickly. But before we do, if you need to upgrade your in-person, in real life, tactile writing experience, Goulet, that's G-O-U-L-E-T, pens.com. Head on over there and check out a huge selection of just gorgeous, beautiful pens. So pick one up there. And then also you do a podcast too, right, Brian?
I do, yeah. Audio podcast, and it's in video form on YouTube as well, because of course it is.
Yeah, and tell people about the podcast and where they can find it.
It is a very long form. It's called the Goulet Pencast, because we love puns and play on words in the pen world. We've done 127 episodes, literally just recorded that today before sitting down with you. But they average over 2 hours at this point. So yeah, me and my buddy Drew, we do that together. We talk about pens. We talk about all kinds of stuff. You can hear about all my outdoor adventures and home projects and stuff going on with my kids and all that. So that's very much like the deep, you know, behind the scenes, inside baseball stuff that's going on there. But we have a YouTube channel that's pretty big too, Goulet Pens. And you can check out, we've got thousands, literally over 2,000 videos in there about fountain pens and how to use them. So that's a good channel to check out too, if you don't want the full 2 hour podcast experience.
Nice. So lightning round, I'm going to give you about half a dozen questions here. Just make sure we get through all of them. Just do single words or single sentence answers. And the first question, how would you describe the environment in e-commerce in 1 to 3 words right now?
Exciting and evolving.
What's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Working with my parents.
If you weren't living where you live now, where would you be?
I've heard you ask this on other podcasts too, and I've thought about it. I'm like, I literally don't know. I live in the town where I grew up, and my family's all nearby. I'd probably live closer to Washington, D.C., which is where my wife's parents live. I don't like it. The pace is busier up there. I don't like it as much, but I would want to be close to family. So that's the only other place I would consider.
Brian, what's your favorite pen that you sell? So if you only get one pen, you're trapped on a desert island, and this is the one pen you write daily with, you know, the notes in, that you put into bottles to beg for people to come save you. What's that one pen that you have?
That's a tough question. I currently have over 1,200 pens in my collection, which sounds ridiculous, and it is. But if I had to only have one, probably the Lamy 2000. It's a German pen. It's Bauhaus designed. It's durable. It looks really cool. It was designed almost 60 years ago, but it still looks futuristic. It's a very cool pen.
What's it called again? We'll link up to it for people who want to check it out.
Yeah. Lamy, L-A-M-Y 2000.
The Lamy 2000. Awesome. I may have to check that out. Hardest part of your business?
Oh my gosh. Probably just caring about people, caring about what happens. It's hard to care, but it's worth it.
Yeah, that's very hard spoken and true. I feel you. How much money in the bank is enough? You can answer either one of two ways. You can say either a lump sum, I have 10 million in the bank, I have 500,000 in the bank, or you can say if I made X amount, if somebody just gave me X amount in perpetuity every year for life, someone gave me $300,000 a year, someone gave me $80,000 a year, whatever it is. So how much money is enough?
That's a great question, because pretty much no matter how much money anybody makes, if you ask them that question, they're going to say double of whatever it is they're currently making.
It's true.
So it's like an unachievable goal. I will say, you know, as long as you're not on the streets and you have enough money to feed yourself and clothe yourself and you're not worried about it each and every single day, that's enough. Like when we started this business, we were eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and Easy Mac. And, you know, we had no time, no money. And we were so freaking happy because we were doing what we loved and we lived just doing our family thing and all that. We had a house that we were able to pay for. Like our needs are very, very simple, you know? So Rachel and I basically were already semi-retired mentally, you know, because we make enough to meet our pretty modest, you know, our modest expectations for ourselves. So anything else is great. I mean, we still work like crazy. We're not semi-retired in terms of like, you know, going on a beach somewhere or whatever, but it's like, you know, we work because we love to work and we love what we do. So yeah, I mean, you don't need a lot.
So we get that. I get that answer a lot, and I have a personal rule. I always have to push back at least once on that to try to get a firm number.
Oh,
so,
sure. I'll give you.
Yeah. So what firm. Would be your firm number either every year or money in the bank for that life?
Yeah, good question. I would probably be more like an every year kind of a guy because I don't think like a dollar number in the bank. I feel like that could get to your head and you could make some dumb investments and then go backwards. So for me, gosh, probably as a family, because my wife and I work together, you know, I would say 80 grand a year, we'd be good.
Nice. How many hours a week do you work?
Oh boy, 40, 45, somewhere around there. It kind of flexes a little bit. I work at night sometimes, you know, it's kind of fluid, but yeah, nothing crazy, but I work hard.
Do you have a favorite charity or cause?
I don't have like one specific charity that I'm associated with, but you know, my wife and I, we give through our church and, you know, we give to a number of different things kind of ad hoc. Yeah. I don't have anything specific, but yeah. We're a little more private with what we give to, but we definitely give on a regular basis.
Number one hobby, and you can't say work.
Oh, work is definitely not my number one hobby. I have too many hobbies, but oh boy, it's hard. Probably my number one most consistent over time has been woodworking. I love woodworking and love tools and all that kind of stuff. I have a lot of other things also that I'm into because, you know, like probably most of our audience, I have ADHD and I've pursued many different things and I've probably picked up 7 or 8 different ones since COVID started, but woodworking is my most consistent hobby. Nice. That I've had.
Nice. Yeah. Last question, who's one of the most interesting people you've met through e-commerce fuel? It doesn't have to be the most, but just someone who comes to mind that either in person you've really enjoyed or their contributions on the forums, whatever it is.
Let's see here. One of the most interesting ones that I keep gravitating to, I actually have two of them. Shane Smith is very interesting. He's done all kinds of crazy stuff and he's super, he's just like one of these guys that's like super savvy and very street smart and you very laid back, but then he's absolute monster when it comes to business. He's really interesting. And then Ross Gordon is another one. I spent a lot of time with Ross in this last one. Just personally, he's just a really, really good guy. A lot of other good people too. Don't want to leave anybody out, but they're both really interesting people I've gotten to know more recently.
Nice. Yeah. Both good dudes. Brian, thank you for coming on, man. Thanks for being a part of ECF over the years. You're telling me you've been to like 10 events, which is just mind-boggling. So
yeah,
it's always so good to have you. I remember when we jumped off, I think I was right behind you, I believe when we jumped off the platform in Charlotte, were we right next to each other? Like it was like a bungee jump thing, but it wasn't bungee jump. You just fell off a cliff or like a platform, I don't know, 200 feet up. I was surprised at how hard it was to take that leap. Was that hard for you?
Nah.
Really?
Nah, man. I like that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I usually like that type of stuff too, but it was good to have a group of people at the bottom who I was going to look, you know, it was expecting me to jump off to get it done.
Yeah. No, it's fun, man. I like that kind of stuff. I like that's my favorite thing, like any type of roller coasters. If it just lifts you up and then just drops you, that like pit in your stomach, I don't know. To me, it just feels like you have no choice but to just like let go and be totally free. So I've never been skydiving because, again, I'm not a super, super risk taker. But if I had no responsibility, wife, kids, business, all that, I would go skydiving like probably every other day because I love that free fall feeling.
Yeah. I've heard though, you don't get the free fall feeling in when you're skydiving. Like when you jump out, you don't get that pit in your, I have not skydived. So there's probably a bunch of people who are talking at their earbuds right now being like,
I've never done it. So I don't know. Yeah. But I would imagine you get that. And maybe once you hit terminal velocity, you just, it kind of stabilizes, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe bungee jumping. Maybe that would do it. Cause you're like just kind of falling and then you get, that I could do. That'd be fun.
That'd be super fun. Well, more hopefully in the future, maybe we'll get an ECF. Maybe when our insurance policy gets 10 times bigger, we'll do an ECF skydiving policy event at some point.
Yeah, I'm sure Audrey would love to plan that one out.
Man. Well, I would love to have the liability of that too. So
I bet our rates would go up quite a bit, I think. Yeah.
No. But Brian, make sure you check out again, GouletPens.com for that fantastic pen we mentioned. If you need to pick up a Lamy 2000, And Brian, thanks for always, man. Always appreciate you and the community at the events and for coming on. It's always a good time, man.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it and love what you've built. This is the best organization that I've ever been a part of.
Dang. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at eCommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.